This episode of Weed Like a Word was recorded via social media during lockdown conditions in the 2020 coronavirus epidemic. Consequently, the sound quality is a bit ropey at times, and so indeed is the quality of the presenters. But nevertheless, enjoy the show.
Like a word
about making films from books. You're listening to Weed Like a Word with me, Paul Waters, and
Stephen Colgan. And on this particular episode, we're going to be talking about making books into movies, and we've got the inimitable John Rain here.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi everybody.
It's a podcast mashup.
Yes,
we've got Weed Like a Word and Smirsh Pod coming together for the first time.
Weed Like a Smirsh.
We'd like a Smirsh.
What is Smirsh?
It's the Russian intelligence agency that was operating in the old days. It actually means spionim, which means death to spies.
Death to spies. Yeah, I like that name.
Yeah.
Ironic, seeing as they are spies.
Exactly. It was the one that was usurped by Spectre. They all defected and went to Spectre because they had better insurance and good discos.
And cooler headquarters.
Exactly.
Generally.
Yeah.
Yeah, Smirsh, it's more like something from Carry On Spying, doesn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Well, there could be a terrible calamity if people got confused between Smirsh and Smash. For Mash, get Smirsh.
Yeah, that would be awful. They'd all be tied up and declared dissidents and dumped in an alley.
By robots from
death
Mars.
Death to pies. Death to pies. That would
death to pies. Very good.
This is so disturbing, seeing my enormous piece on this video.
It kind of looks like we're virtually mugging you.
Or something even more intimate. You see, listeners, at the minute we're doing this over Zoom, and John looks absolutely fine, normal, sitting there, talking into a microphone. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting here eating biscuits at the wrong time and, you know, coughing when bits go down the wrong way. But Steve, all I can see is a big hairy chin. I hope that's what it is anyway. Please God.
Yeah.
And occasionally a large pink orifice. Because he's got his face so close to the computer so we can hear him properly.
Yeah, well, so you can hear me, yeah.
In the meantime, it's quite unpleasant. I'm going to try and avert my eyes.
Good. So, John, Smirsh Pod, a love letter to James Bond, isn't it?
Yeah, I grew up obsessed with it. It was something that was always in the forefront of my mind. And when podcasts became a thing, I'd always look out for one that was, you know, going the direction I wanted to go in, which was to deal with it with reverence, but also take the piss out of it because it's quite stupid. And there wasn't really anything that I could find, so I decided to do one myself. That's how it started.
So, and now, just in case anyone's not heard of Smirsh Pod, each episode, you kind of dissect a particular Bond film, and you've been through all the Bond films now. And the idea is you have a guest on.
That's right.
And you've done all of the Bond films now, I think.
That's right, yeah, I'm doing them for the second time now.
Is there any more to say about them?
Yeah, well, because I'm getting different guests on, and, you know, different points of view, and I just, you know, really like them. And plus, the new film was supposed to be coming out, so it was to kind of chime in with that. But that's now been pushed back to November, so I'm just doing it anyway. And now, because we're all living in this virtual lockdown world, I'm still continuing to do it, but having to do it much like this.
Oh, have you had, two suggestions for you, have you had Eddie Joseph on? So Eddie Joseph, you probably know all this already. He is was a sound editor and sound designer, one of the main men behind the scenes on Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. So you know that brilliant opening sequence on Casino Royale in East Africa when they go through the building site? He's fighting and there's a chase, that scene. So he did the sound on that. And it's just fascinating to hear how, because, of course, there's Bond music as well, and how mixing the music, which is somebody else's department, and the sound, his department, and kind of the tension between the music is everything, we need crescendos continually, and him wanting to have the impact. He's a very good guy. And there was somebody else we may have on the podcast, a guy called Dougie Brimson, who may be less central to Bond, but he might know him from Green Street and kind of football hooligan-related films. And he's got a book, In the Know, out at the minute. And he's in the background of a Pierce Brosnan one. Not sure which one, but driving a car and hanging around anyway. So he may have some insights for the future.
The thing is, Bond is such a huge franchise and it's been going for so long. It's like that, everyone will be famous for 5 minutes. Everyone will eventually have some connection to a Bond film. I certainly know three or four people who have worked on the Bond films, including special effects guys and sound people and set builders, because it has gone on for years and years and years and years. I mean, I used to watch all the Bond films as a kid, but my first, just how extraordinary the films were, the 007 soundstage, because in callow youth, back in the early 1980s, I was a police officer, and I was friendly with the neighbouring Thames Valley police officers who worked at Denham, because they were just over the border from us. There was a lot of cross-border stuff went on. And they arranged for us to go and have a look at Pima Studios.
Wow.
But we got to look at the 007 soundstage, which was extraordinary. And the next time I got to see it was a couple of years later in 1984, when I watched it burning down. Because I happened to be on the night shift at Uxbridge the night. So, of course, you know, being good operational police officers, we all drove down there and stood and watched the fire. We all stood there and went, ooh, looking at the fire. It was huge.
Steve, you're a sad loss to policing, by the sounds of it.
I think so.
And the fire brigade, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, so, no, we let them get on with it. They knew what they were doing. It was a big fire. I mean, we were sitting maybe half a mile away, and it was still like a column of flame. It was huge.
That was the Ridley Scott film Legend they were filming when that
it was, yes, out. Yeah.
And they rebuilt it really quick. Yeah. I think within a few months it was rebuilt.
Going back to the topic of books and Bond, the Ian Fleming books have all been made into films, haven't they?
Ish. I mean, they've used bits and pieces of them, and there's a few short stories they haven't made just because they're not really film-worthy. Like, there's one where, I think it's called James Bond in New York, where he just literally goes to America and stays in a hotel for a night and then goes home. Mm-hmm. So things like that they haven't bothered with. They've cherry-picked bits and pieces out of all sorts of novels. Like, there's bits of Live and Let Die and License to Kill. There's bits of Live and Let Die in all sorts of other places. And
what about the continuity novels, then? Which of those have been used in films?
As far as I know, none of them. I think there's little elements here and there. Like, there was a book called Colonel Sun, and in Die Another Day, the villain was Colonel Sun, I believe, or related to Colonel Sun.
So Colonel Sun, was that Robert Markham, Kingsley Amis?
Yes, I think so. Yes, he was, yeah.
Now, that was maybe the first one. Do you have a preference for the continuity novels? Which ones do you like or hate? Or
I don't actually read them.
Yeah, why not?
I don't really. I started to read License Renewed, which is a John Gardner one.
Right.
And it just kind of, I suppose because my mind growing up was so visual in terms of Bond, and I was so, what I love about Bond is how it looks, how it sounds, how it feels. And I just think that gets lost in the, certainly the continuity novels, because you don't know which Bond you're dealing with. So,
okay.
Yeah, I just didn't get on with them.
There have been some really good ones. We had on the podcast Anthony Horowitz, who's done two. Trigger Mortis, I have them here. Trigger Mortis, which is a good name, and Forever and a Day, not such a good name. But good. Both really good. And you know, there's other good people like Sebastian Faulks, William Boyd, Jeffrey Deaver. So it's not as if somebody's just churning them out.
I'm not saying that. It's just down to personal preference. It's just something I'm not particularly interested in, I think.
Mm.
But John makes an interesting point, because I read the Horowitz books in preparation for the podcast and instantly went, this is either Connery or Dalton. And in the end, I decided it was Dalton. What Bond did you read as it was?
I see what you mean. I guess I would go Connery, because one of them was from the very start, and one then was from the very end, which was kind of unusual that he was bookending the Ian Flemings. I guess Connery with ruthlessness and a bit of naivety, mainly, maybe.
Should we go back to the actual Fleming books? Because I've read a few of them, and I can't actually ally any of those with any of the actors who've played Bond.
Well, certainly,
it's a really weird thing. It like exists in a different universe to the films.
Well, Fleming had his head turned anyway, didn't he? Because when they made Dr. No and he came and saw Connery, from then on in, that was who he was writing for. He saw Connery and thought, that's my James Bond. He even changed a bit of continuity and introduced the fact that Bond had Scottish heritage, which wasn't there previously, just because he loved Connery so much. And I think that's interesting because he died, obviously, I think just as they made Goldfinger. So he never got to see anyone else play Bond. So I think that's really interesting that in Fleming's mind, that was it. He was sold on Connery. And I'd love to know what he'd have thought of more. I mean, I assume he'd have loved Dalton because he's probably the closest to the novels on purpose. And probably would have loved Craig as well. So it'll be interesting to know what he thought. But certainly when he died, he went to his grave thinking that Sean Connery was a man.
So Timothy Dalton, the most faithful film representation, also the least successful.
Yeah, people weren't ready for it. I always say it's like at the end of Back to the Future when Marty McFly does that over-the-top guitar solo to all the kids from the 1950s, and he says, you know, your parents are going to love it. I feel like that about Dalton, because he was doing what Craig does now. But at the time, everybody was so used to Roger Moore with planes flying out of horses' asses and underwater cars that they weren't ready for James Bond, who was just headbutting people and would murder anybody who got in his way. You know, because Roger had certainly gone out of his way on quite a few occasions saying, no, my Bond wouldn't do that. Whereas Dalton was very much like, whose throat can I slit now, please?
Roger Moore, I mean, I will express a preference here. I like the Moore films more than any of the other Bond films, mm-hmm. because they aren't, I mean, apart from a couple of really quite odd character moments where he slaps women and things like that, he's the comic relief Bond. It's where the gadgets got sillier and the stunts got bigger. And
interesting
for me, I suppose because that's my age as well, because I was born 61. The films were coming into the cinema when I was that age to go, oh my God, wow, and see them actually when it came out originally. So it was a very different tone after he left.
It's interesting though, because they tried to change Roger with For Your Eyes Only, even though they bookend it with most ridiculous scenes ever in a Bond film ever, with the disabled man being chucked down the chimney and then at the end Janet Brown doing Margaret Thatcher. But in between that, there's that famous scene that Moore had to really be talked into, where he kicks the assassin's car so it falls off the cliff. And again, Roger would say, that's not my Bond, I wouldn't do that. But at the end, they talked him into it, saying it was going to go anyway. You didn't do anything, you just kicked it. But then certainly that didn't stick, because then you got Octopussy and then View to a Kill, which are probably as far away from being hard Bond films as you can get.
And of course, there's the perennial discussion about who could have been Bond. Because, I mean, there's so many different names that have come up over the years. I mean, the front runner for a long time was Michael Billington, wasn't it, who ended up UFO and then disappearing into obscurity. Well, I think
he's actually in The Spy Who Loved Me as well.
Yeah, that's right, he was, yeah. And there was talk at some time, wasn't there, of, what's his name, Adam West?
Yeah, and Burt Reynolds.
What an extraordinary thing that would have been.
Cary Grant as well at one point.
Well, I could imagine Cary Grant.
Really?
This was pre-Connery.
Yeah, I can maybe imagine that.
I can almost imagine Adam West,
if he was doing a sort of Roger Moore type Bond, because he could do a very good English accent.
But there's also, what's his name? James Garner. No, not James Garner. Who am I thinking of? James Brolin, beg your pardon. He had a screen test for Octopussy. He got very close to getting the part. And Sam Neill, before Dalton got The Living Daylights, he had a screen test. And then you've got people like Lewis Collins, who came in for an interview but didn't get a screen test because he just pissed everybody off, apparently. There's all sorts of people. There's a great book, you know, there's a few books out there that delve into it a little bit. But it's an interesting story to be told about people who were nearly James Bond, definitely.
So who would you want?
Well, now?
Yeah, now.
I get shot down for a lot, but I really like Henry Cavill.
Yeah, I can see that.
He reminds me a bit of Brosnan. If you got Brosnan and Moore and just mush them together, he reminds me a bit of that, because he's a bit silly. He's a bit aware of how ridiculous he is a bit.
So was the Man from U.N.C.L.E. his audition?
Well, it could have been, couldn't it? And he said in interviews that he'd definitely love to play it. But if not him, I don't know. I mean, I quite like Dan Stevens as well. I watched The Guest. I don't know if you've seen that, but he's brilliant in that.
I mean, of course, there's been all the discussions going on, you know, as we've had sort of huge overturning of cultural icons with things like the first female Doctor Who, etc. There's been all discussions about a female Bond or a black Bond and that sort of thing. Yeah. It took me back to, I can remember years ago, and there was apparently a script that was going around that basically said that 007 is an assignation, and it gets given to different agents. And the idea was that they wanted to try and do a Connery, Moore, and all the others in it, because someone was basically knocking off the old 007s. But it would set it up that anyone could play 007 in the future, no matter who or what they were. It's just their shoulder number, as it were. You know,
which is the case in the new one, isn't it?
Is that the case? Yeah.
Yeah, she takes over the 007 role. But I don't like the thing that is, they're not saying that 007's the assignation or the code name. They're saying that the name James Bond is, which makes me laugh because then you'd have three Bonds in a row who are mourning a wife that wasn't theirs.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like, here's the keys to the office, here's the car, and this is the where your wife's buried.
Here's your emotional baggage.
Yeah, it wouldn't really work. So yeah. I think in that respect, I don't like the idea because it would take a lot of retconning to sort it out. I think we just have to live in the denial that exists in the James Bond films, and much the same way as it does, you know, with Doctor Who regenerating, as you mentioned before. It's like, this is just James Bond. This is who he is, and now he looks slightly different.
I'd be quite happy with Idris Elba. As long as he's not too old. But, I mean, he's much younger than some of the Bonds.
He's 50.
There you go. Young.
No, you have to be about 37, 38. Because these films, they used to take 2 years to make.
Hell, Roger Moore that.
Well, Roger Moore started when he was 46. And he finished when he was 50. Yeah. Something like that. 56, something like that. But that was when they were making them every year or every 2 years. But now it's taken them, what, 5-6 years to make them?
Yeah.
By the time Idris does one, he does another one, he'll be nearly 60.
Yeah, I suppose they could do a Robert De Niro in The Irishman with him, but maybe it would be simpler just to get someone else.
Kind of looks like Frankenstein's monster all the way through it. The bit where Joe Pesci comes along and goes, "How can I help you, kid?" And you look over and Robert De Niro looks 50 years old. You're like, no, this isn't working for me.
Now, the other thing is, of course, you've done the opposite of the Bond franchise and the fact that it's gone from books to film. You've gone from podcast to book because you brought out Thunderbook.
Yes.
Last year, I think it was, wasn't it? It came out.
Yeah, November last year, yeah.
I mean, it's very funny. I mean, it's again, it's just to describe it for someone who hasn't come across it. Thunderbook is the sort of written down version of Smirch Pod. It's a series of essays basically tacking each one of the Bond films in sequence. That must have been fun.
It was.
Give us a weird or fun fact from Bond, and as a throw ahead to the next part.
Okay, well, in Dr. No, when Bond is meeting M for the first time in the film Dr. No, M tells him that they're working for MI7, but it's clearly dubbed and his lips are saying MI6. So I think that's quite strange.
Well, we will hear more weird and wonderful things about James Bond in the second part of We'd Like a Word with John Rainey.